What is enlightenment? What happens? What is it?
You wake up.
Yes, but what does it entail?
Seeing things as they are.
Yeah, a shift in view. That's all it is a shift in view. We can talk about seeing things as they are, but if we haven't had the experience, it's simply words that our intellectual mind starts to grapple with, trying to figure it out. Enlightenment is experiential. It has nothing to do with the intellect. Each one of you are here because somewhere inside there's an inkling that there's more. And the more is already innately who each one of you is. When lamas talk about realizing true nature of mind, it's not my mind or your mind or Joe's mind or Mildred's mind, because everybody I met who has had the experience, they may have come to it in different directions, but the experience itself was exactly the same for everyone. So realizing that is something that transcends this body, which is impermanent. All of you, I am sure, have had a glimpse, or you've had a moment that you may not have understood, but where everything just seemed clear and full, like nothing was missing. But since there was no place to put that experience, we kind of gloss it over and go on. It's like if we have a deja vu experience and it's at a place that we've never been before. At least we have a name for it, it's deja vu. But we can't really explain it. We can't really explain being present, but if the meditation just stays on the cushion, and then you go out and live your life and, well, no, I'm not meditating now. I did it this morning or I did it last night. Then nothing's going to happen. When I did my 3-year retreat, the only thing Rinpoche said is, remember, you can sit on your bottom for 3 years, do all the practices, and nothing happens. Because if one doesn't get out of their head or doesn't get out of feeling full of, oh my heavens, I'm on 3-year retreat, isn't that wonderful? Like the first time I went to Asia, I was so caught up in going to Asia, I was never there. And then after I kept going back and back, I felt so free when I first got off the plane. It only took me 2 weeks to set up the same dynamics around me so that people were reacting to me in the same way they did over here or in my family. We have to approach everything with a sense of wonder and allow for the possibility that we really don't know what this life is all about. And we let what our past was, the memories of our past, define us now. And in this moment, we're defining what's to come because we're not here, we're thinking about tomorrow, or I have to do this, or yada, yada, yada. Being present takes practice because everything about our life, from the time we were born, and probably our previous lives, was geared towards, for the most part, a dualistic life. And when you start studying the Dharma, it's not about what the other person did, what happened in the past, what I'm going to do tomorrow. It's who I am now, right at this moment. Because this very moment is where all the possibilities and potential lie. It's not how much you've read, how well you remember it. It's, is your heart open? When you're with people, are you truly seeing them and acknowledging them? The greatest gift we can give to anybody is to acknowledge them. But it takes us being present. How many times if you're going to work, do you get in your car, and how many of the times do you not really remember what was between point A and B? And what were the possibilities? What does the steering wheel feel like in your hands? The sounds around you. If you're thinking about, oh my heavens, I'm running late, then you aren't present anyway because you've already created what you think the circumstances will be if you're late. The most important meditation is the 23, 22, 20 hours off the cushion. If you find yourself reacting to somebody, why is it so important that you have to be right? What are you protecting? We all have a terminal illness. It's called life. So we've got nothing to really protect. And you practice now so that when your time to pass comes, whether it's fast, say a car accident, or it's a drawn out illness, that you already have a sense of feeling and experience of being present. So at that moment, You're in a moment of grace and you pass with grace. How does karma follow us into the next life? Have you really thought about that? If we are in essence energy, I mean, the scientists have proved that now. And any sort of denial or evasion or ignorance of who each of us really are is like a constriction on the energy. That, if that constriction is still there, and the base of all obscurations, the bottom of it is always fear. And if when we pass, it's that constriction itself which helps to determine what our coming experience will be, just like it is in this life from moment to moment. Does that make sense?
Would you say that again?
Oh, God.
Oh, never
mind. Sorry.
Never mind. That's okay.
It's about, what I heard was that it's about, if you're constricted at that moment of death, then, to get to the next life, that's a difficult passage, just as we experience every day.
Well, the constriction itself determines.
Yeah.
What the next life will be, just as how we are in one moment here determines what the next moment is going to be. I just needed to get started.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you. It's exciting, the possibilities we have. When the Karmapa was dying, he was in a hospital in Chicago. He had stomach cancer, which is, on a relative level, is very, very painful. Every day the doctors would come, "Do you want some pain meds?" And he would laugh and say no. And it isn't that there wasn't anything going on. It was, he didn't label and define it and let that determine who he was. It was simply a sensation. And, all the high lamas were there. I'll just finish the story. And then the Karmapa died. The doctors diagnosed that he had passed. And then they left the room, I guess, to get a gurney or something, and the lamas locked the door. And, the hospital, everybody's knocking on the door. "You have to let us take the body." Finally, 3 days later, they opened the door. The head of the hospital came in and went over to Karmapa, and his face was rosy. The only place on his body that there was any heat at all was around the heart center. And this hospital, the head of the hospital burst into tears because this wasn't death as he knew it. But for each one of us, being present moment by moment, it doesn't mean you can't work. In fact, you would probably be much better because you would flow rather than interrupt with your mind. Oh, I had another sentence before that one.
It was about even if we work.
He's my interpreter.
I don't know how to sign it. So being present doesn't mean that we can't do other things, like work at our jobs or whatever. So.
Yeah, but it had something to do with, oh yes. The impact that Karmapa had on the head of the hospital is the same impact that someone who is present has on the people around them. That's where, for the benefit of all sentient beings, that's where it happens. It's not something you do. Compassion isn't, in essence, isn't acting in a compassionate way or acting in a loving way. When you're present, compassion, love, is an expression of who you are. It's no longer something you do. Do you follow me? And all of this is already within us. But as we go through our relative life, we're thinking about tomorrow, or if only my parents hadn't been that way, or had, we think there's stuff we have to get over, or if my husband was different, then I would be happy. Even joy is an expression of being present. We can't manipulate what's outside of us and create happiness or peace for ourselves. That will simply be impermanent. That's already saying there's something wrong with us. There's something lacking. But none of you would be here seeking out Dharma teachings if somewhere inside of you, you knew that it's not something outside of you, because every moment of joy or peace that you have had bubbled up from inside, was not dependent on something outside. And it doesn't matter if you're brand new to Dharma and you're in your 30s or you're in your 80s. A shift in view isn't determined by training. There's a lot of saints out there and have been who haven't read all of the books and studied all of the teachings. And some of the things, Ayin Rinpoche tells people to be very careful about reading too much. And I got an understanding of that when I was reading the Treasury of Knowledge, Jemgon Kontrol. It was the first book, Myriad Worlds. And he says in there very clearly, if you're talking in Dharma, if you're talking about the disciplines or something like that, is something you read with your relative mind. But if you're moving into philosophy or the nature of phenomena, you can't do that with your relative mind. You have to, the self, the ego has to step back, because the relative mind cannot understand something that transcends the relative. This is why a lot of the questions, like, but when did it all begin? And the Lama will say, well, it never did. And people, I mean, I used to get so frustrated. But it's all here and now. Right now. I mean, I had a funny little moment before we started. I was listening to the birds outside the window, and they were sounded just like the sound effects that my Chinese acupuncturist has going when he's giving me a treatment. And I had my eyes closed, and for a second I wasn't sure where I was, and it was like the rug was pulled out. And before my mom died, we had gone to the Maxfield Parish Museum up in White River Junction in Vermont. How many of you know Maxfield Parish? The Blues, mm-hmm. Yeah. And mom and I are sitting in the dining room and having tea and scones or something. It's fall at the height of the season. There's a huge picture window. And you look out and the trees are just every imaginable color. And then I watched mom turn her head and look over here. There was a painting by Maxfield Parrish, the exact size of the window at the exact same season. And my mother was going like this. And I reminded her, she asked me, when she was dying, she asked me why I became a Buddhist. And I reminded her of that moment, and I said, I became a Buddhist because there's more. And she had tears streaming down her eyes. There's magic in each moment. The only reason we don't experience it is because we let our minds be elsewhere. And you're working against yourself in many different ways then. Because when you hold on to a thought, when you aren't present, it's simply a thought that you're holding on to. It takes physical energy to hold on to a thought. So something in your physical body has tensed up. Kind of amazing, isn't it? That's one of the ways when you're meditating that you can if you find yourself following a thought, check out the body and relax what it is that habitually tightens up. Any comments? Any questions? Disagreements are fine too.
Well, to me, the something more, I think everyone in our society is very good at trying to hold on to thoughts and deal with conventional reality and all that, which we all have to do too. But
Wait, rephrase that.
Okay.
Because if you say that to yourself, the have to becomes a statement you live by.
Well, so we all
are in the habit of
dealing with conventional reality on conventional terms and using our relative minds, etc. But I think one difference when you say something more, and that's why I became a Buddhist, to me that resonates with the recognition that what you said about holding on to thoughts, it doesn't have to be that way if you're in the present moment. That you can
You
can put those, you can put all that burden down of carrying those thoughts and holding on to them, because it is work. It is hard work.
You know, I think it's even easier than that, because when you're present, it's not putting it down. Mm-hmm. It just isn't there.
It isn't there.
Just isn't there. Yes?
How do you know when your reading gets in the way of your practice? You're talking about the intellectual versus experiential thing. And I got into Dharma primarily from a philosophical standpoint to begin with. Like, I spent years reading sutra and stuff before I had ever even attempted, like, meditating. And I think that my overly intellectual approach really gets in the way a lot of times, but I don't really know how to tell when, because I don't think it would make sense for me either to just stop reading Dharma books entirely. So.
No, but if... Even when you're reading, how about being aware through the senses of what's going on around you? Mm-hmm. I mean, the intellect is, it can be used, or we can think that that's who we are. And if we think that's who we are, we're caught.
Right. That's what we're saying.
But if it's a tool we're using, and then when we aren't doing it, we just...
Right.
Then there's no problem.
Right. So just don't be your intellectual activity, okay?
Yeah. This guy over here got caught for years and years.
I haven't stopped thinking, but I sure think a lot less.
And it's when he started doing your noontime practice?
I think so.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Something you said brought back a comment I heard of a Pasadena teacher, a Theravadan teacher, say, where they were talking about how we're always trying to, you know, make things better, change the circumstances of our life, and they said it's like rearranging the decks, the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, life is
it's still going to go down.
Right.
Yeah. Well, using that analogy, if you were to think of this life as being on the deck of a ship in the storm, in the storm, because that's what samsara is. And what is your job? To constantly rebalance. That's not what's going to happen tomorrow, because then you probably slide off the deck. But this life is like a schoolroom. You can't take it so seriously. It will end. Is it easy? No. But whether you take it seriously or you lighten up on yourself, getting tense and upset doesn't fix anything. Because when you're tense, you're in a state of fear. Your energy has all drawn in. I kind of one time when I was teaching, I came up with I always get analogy and metaphor mixed up, but anyway, whatever, that each one of us have our own personal theme park. That's what my ego creates, my own person. They're different colors, they have different rides, and I only let people into my theme park that I want. And I spend my whole life protecting my theme park. And the theme park is only a concept, but we protect the ideas that we have built up of who and what we are. And some people protect it to the death. You know, in talking about refuge, you can take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, which in essence is the innate purity of your own body, speech, and mind. It's not something outside of you. It's already there. But how many people do you know who are taking refuge in their anger, or in their 4,000 square foot house, or their nice car, or their job, or their career? Everybody takes refuge in something, even if it's not Dharma. But all the other refuges reinforce this pseudo-self that one creates. We all probably have our stories of where we came from, who we are. To the point that our stories are living our life, not us. Several years ago, some brave soul pointed out to me that being a nun was my story. Because it set up the dynamics of any relationship I might have. And didn't allow for equal exchange. In other words, I wasn't really acknowledging other people. Of course, I thought him wrong at first, and I defended myself. But he was absolutely right. And so then, during the next 6-8 months, I went back to the drawing board, and it was like throwing out everything and taking back what was authentic. Oh, it sounds so easy to say it, but it wasn't. My idea of my teacher, I had to go out too and come back. I mean, there was a month, 2 months in there, and I had already been a nun for 20 years. But my stories weren't, my idea of who I was wasn't allowing me to be present. And my feelings before that was like I had hit a brick wall. What am I doing? This doesn't make any sense. Well, it wasn't it, Dharma, that wasn't making any sense. It was my story wasn't allowing any flow. So this evening, before you go to sleep, please, please, please think about that. You're taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But think further that this is the innate essence of who you are. 1 year, when I was traveling with Ayin Rinpoche, we were in Canada, and he had gone to the, it was winter, and he had gone to the Nepali embassy because his passport was so fat and full that he had to get more in it, more pages. And Cynthia and I went across the street and sat in a Catholic church because it wasn't really seating up at the Nepali mission in Toronto. So we're sitting in the church, and I find the words popping out of me. It's so much more difficult having God on the inside than on the outside. Yeah. Because then we're responsible. We're creating our life. Moment by moment. It's no one else's fault. There's no if onlys or what ifs. How about taking a 5-minute break?